show all about people's personal journeys to Bitcoin. In this episode, I speak with Daniel Prince, host of the Once Bitten podcast and author of Choose Life. We chat about life as a Forex broker, the decision to quit the rat race and travel as a family, and the world of homeschooling. Listen to learn what it feels like navigating hectic financial markets, why 18 years as a broker left him wanting something different, and how the steps he's consequently taken have left him with an immense sense of freedom. As someone just starting a young family, Daniel's story is truly inspirational, and proof that by thinking a little differently, there is a rich and engaging lifestyle out there for everyone. Daniel, once again, thank you so much for your time. Now, I'd like to take a quick moment to mention my sponsor, FastBitcoins.com. They're a Bitcoin-only exchange based in the Isle of Man on a really exciting journey. If you'd like to learn more about them, I encourage you to search back through my episode library and listen to a couple of key conversations. Firstly, Danny Brewster, the founder CEO, and secondly, Nathan Smith, the Chief Compliance Officer. Both stories give an excellent insight into the people building the business. In the coming weeks, you can expect a custom referral link, which you can also use on sign-up to get the best possible rates. We haven't quite put the finishing touches on it, so please keep your eyes peeled. Now, on with the show. Hello and welcome to Bitcoin with Jake. Today I'm speaking with Daniel Prince. Welcome, Daniel.
Nice to be here, mate. Thanks for inviting me on.
Absolute pleasure. We had the we had a chance to chat on my previous YouTube show with Jigs and Matty, We're So Bloody Early, which we did about 6 months ago, and that's evolved into this podcast where I'm focusing just on Bitcoin. So I confess to knowing a bit of your story already, but I'm very excited to go through parts of it again, and I'm sure there'll be some extra stuff that comes to light. So yeah, thank you for joining me again.
You're the Robbie Williams of We're So Bloody Early. Is that yeah. What's happened here?
He's gone solo. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Robbie Williams,
and let's not forget, you've been on my pod as well, so
that's true. So you know a bit more about me at this stage than I know the other way around. Yeah. Okay, well, Daniel, let's kick it off. So this is a show all about Bitcoin, and particularly focused on people's personal journeys. So just as a kickoff question, you've probably got a mate out there somewhere who told you about Bitcoin and you said, fuck off, you are talking complete crap, I'm not listening to you. But whoever they are, shout out to them for your first kind of touch point with it. Talk me through the process of becoming a Bitcoiner. Like, what was it that first caught your interest? And it's probably a lot longer than a short answer, but it often brings to light plenty of things I can draw out from. So take us away with, what brought you to Bitcoin?
Yeah, sure. Actually, there was no mate. And the reason being, I was kind of mateless at the time because I'd unplugged from my existing life before that. So anyway, we'll get to that. I suppose a little bit of the backstory. I worked in fiat land for 18 years in a career in the financial markets, primarily foreign exchange, 17 years in foreign exchange. So exchanging fiat currencies for a living. And I started in the UK in London in the mid 90s. And I walked on to what's known as the spot dollar mark desk when we still had Deutschmarks. And that was the most widely traded currency pair by far across the world. The second largest was dollar yen. And then closely following that behind would have been most likely sterling dollar, which is called cable. Interesting historical story to that. Just a quick side note. The reason it's called cable is because that was the first currency pair that was exchanged over the telegraphic cable, the cable that was laid across the seabed between the UK and the US.
Wow.
So to this day, in financial markets, if you're trading sterling against dollar, it's still called cable.
I've heard people describe it as cable. Cable's roofing, mate, or whatever it might be that they say. And you're like, okay, what does that mean? And you hear it's a currency pair. You're like, oh, okay, wow. But I had no idea that that's why it was called that. I love all the nicknames of this kind of world. There's so many different insider jokes and whatever that you find out along the way.
Even more obscurely, it's called Betty.
And why is it called Betty?
After Betty Grable, because it's Cockney rhyming slang for cable. So you were here in the dealing rooms. Have you got any 1 month Betty? Or like, where's Betty in 100?
Wow.
So they would be the kind of random call. So anyway, that's where I started cutting my teeth in financial markets. Moved to Singapore in 1999, and that's where I carried on in those markets, just in the Far East, and worked across emerging market currencies, as well as what you'd call the G7 or the more well-known currencies, such as the yen, the dollar, the pound, the euro. Because obviously as well, his first touch point really, without even realizing it, was seeing the euro come into being and just destroying people's livelihoods, because all of a sudden the dollar mark desk gone.
Didn't exist.
No more. Wow. Doesn't exist. The mark yen desk doesn't exist. The euro sterling desk needs to be built, but the mark sterling desk is gone. So all of these people were losing their jobs because the powers that be had decided, of course, that they were going to manipulate nation states' currencies and bring them all under one, which is obviously a huge globalist maneuver when you see it now through the lens of Bitcoin and looking back on, you know, what they were actually trying to achieve. It wasn't more sovereignty and a better deal for any of these countries. A lot of these countries got absolutely wrecked, like Spain, Italy, Portugal, etc.
Yeah, Greece.
When they had their currencies rug pulled from underneath them, and people had their savings rug pulled, because guess what, guys, when you wake up tomorrow, it's going to be euro, and here's the fixed currency exchange that unelected bureaucrats have decided on your behalf. It blows my mind now.
It is extraordinary when you start kind of peeling back the layers of the onion. You're just like, whoa, I did not expect to be researching this, but it really is like quite extraordinary how it's been sold to the general public, right? I mean, it's incredible marketing. But yeah, before we get too conspiratorial, what I'm keen to understand, so you know, 17-18 years, that's a long time. And to my mind, that's plenty of time to become a genuine expert at something. So from that experience, what were some of the biggest skills that you gained from that as a day-to-day job? What did you learn about? Mm-hmm. Can you give a bit more flavor to someone that doesn't understand what Forex is, what it really involved on a day-to-day basis?
Yeah.
And probably why does it exist? Like, why do you even need to have a Forex broker?
Yeah, very good question. Why is there even a foreign exchange market? Say for
Dean, yeah, exactly. So you mentioned, let's start at the dollar Deutschmark. So what that desk that no longer existed as soon as the euro came into existence, but prior to that, it's fascinating. It's the largest currency pairing globally, which I assume is, you know, German export nation of like great technologies, huge infrastructure businesses. People are buying that in US dollars, which was the most globally traded currency. And as a result, there's a huge market for switching Deutschmarks into USD, just as a guess.
You nailed it. That's exactly why.
And so, why does that market exist? And as a Forex broker, what do you do in that position?
Well, those markets exist, as Saif explains in the Fiat Standard, which everybody should definitely read if they haven't. Basically, we came off the gold standard, and the dollar and the petrodollar system basically came into power, and all commodities, all exchange around the world is settled in US dollars. So even if Japan were buying German goods, they're not exchanging yen for marks. They've still got to use the US dollar system to buy those goods and to settle those trades. And you know that in your business, shipping is exactly the same. Yeah. You know, if you're shipping iron ore from one country to another, even if they do not denominate their currency in US dollar, that trade will be done in US dollars.
Yeah, absolutely.
So then this creates this
huge, I think, just to jump in, Daniel, it's, I think 90% of global trade is settled in US dollar. Right. Something as could be as high as that. So extraordinary amount. I agree. So that's exactly what we do. Moving cargo from one country to another, could be between two nation states, have nothing to do with America. The contract's denominated in US dollars.
Absolutely. And then you're locked into their systems as well, right? The perfect example being the SWIFT system.
Okay.
That you would use to make those transactions. So when you have huge conglomerates doing these kind of deals, and you are shipping huge amounts of product around the world, you know, car companies, I suppose, are a very good example. If you're shipping container loads of cars to different places in the world, and you are receiving US dollars, but you want that to be in Deutschmarks, for example, then you're going to need to plug into a bank to help you make that exchange. And that bank is therefore going to then go into the market itself, because it could just exchange that for you, or it could then go into the market and try and make money against what, you know, they've received. So they would come to the market and try and hedge any kind of exposure that they have to this company. And then you think about, well, if every single company is doing that, and the size of these companies and the amount of goods, and you look at like the big companies like Nestle, Unilever, Mars,
Coca-Cola, massive companies.
All of them. And this global trade that is happening every single second of every single day, there's huge amounts of foreign exchange that needs to take place because people need to get into and out of the dollar again. So that creates a huge marketplace. Huge marketplaces create huge opportunity for people to, play in these markets, not just do the general transactions and be done with it, because there's money to be made there as well, right? So then you have specialized desks that would be called proprietary trading desks that would try and look at geopolitical events, try and follow the market, try and see, you know, closely track stock exchanges, what companies are, you know, producing more goods because they've got a big customer base, etc. And then we'll try and trace place trades either in the spot market or in futures markets or in options markets, which all started kind of maturing after 10, 20, 30 years of this system being put in place after 1971. So that's that was my job. I found myself in one of those seats as a foreign exchange broker, and we would service the banks. The banks would come to us and ask us for prices on forward date deliveries, be it 1 month, 2 month, 3 month, out to like 5 or even 20 year exchange rates in the future, which they wanted to lock into a contract with another party. It was our job then to take their order anonymously to the marketplace, which was basically a team of guys on a desk plugged into every single bank and just asking them for, would you have interest in this? Would you be able to put a price on this? Can we, start negotiating on something? And after, I don't know, it might take a couple of hours, a couple of days in some cases, you might reach the conclusion that there's absolutely no interest for this in the marketplace from anybody else, or yes, we found a buyer, we found a seller, and we can put the deal together, and we would charge commission on putting those parties together. That was my job. It was very fast moving, very fast paced, great atmosphere to be around if you like that kind of environment. It was very toxic, much like a fraternity house kind of environment, I would liken it to. Great fun, real good bunch of guys for the most part, really witty, but highly stressed, highly strung, young man's game. And in the end, I think I got to about the age of 35 when I realized that, you know, this is it for me. I'm done. I've got four kids at home. This is untenable. And I could also see, after the 2008 financial crisis, like, you know, just asking questions like, how does this game keep afloat? Like, where is this money coming from? Like, why is this? Like, all I'm doing is passing numbers down a line and across a screen, and we're charging money for it. It doesn't make sense. You know, it was weird. But I certainly never ever questioned what is money, you know, the classic Bitcoin question. When I was surrounded by money my entire adult life and career.
It's so incredible, that, isn't it? I would completely echo your sentiment. Like, I went to business school, did my undergraduate business management degree, steamed into a, you know, central urban area to work in a white collar job, and I ended up professional in the shipbroking space, and I never asked the question, what is money? It's quite amazing. It was never educated to me, that's for sure. In the work life I ended up in, it was never part of that. So I'm intrigued by, you mentioned the 08 crisis.
Your shipbroking, you were basically doing the same as I was doing, but for ships and commodities.
Yes.
I was just doing it for money.
So I'm actually in my second phase of shipbroking. So I did it from 2011 to 2016, and I then quit and was in the startup space for 5 years trying to build digital products, and none of my ideas were a success. So ended up requiring a job, and the best paying salary I could find was not in another startup, funnily enough, but back working as a shipping broker. So yeah, that's what I do as my day job at the moment. And it has some very, very interesting and kind of rich sides to it, but then equally at the end of the day, it's just a job. So here I am at, 9 o'clock at night talking about Bitcoin on a podcast. So you can see where my passions lie. It is, you do get to a point though. And it's one of the reasons I quit the first time around. It's like, what am I doing? Like, what am I actually doing here? And we're all bad for it as brokers. You're competitive with each other. You want to make money. You go out for nice dinners. You send clients on holidays. You do all these crazy things that, wouldn't be possible without the profession you end up becoming expert in. But you get so close to the game, you forget the bigger picture, basically. And that's one of the fun things about getting into Bitcoin, is it teaches you to take a step back and really start investigating what's actually going on here. Before I tell too much of my story though, Daniel, I'm intrigued as to, you mentioned you started in the Forex markets in the 90s. You wouldn't have quit until, I think it was like, 2012 or something, 2014. I started reading your book, Choose Life, recently. So shout out to that. I'm halfway through. It's brilliant. Yeah. There would have been a number of big geopolitical moments during that, let's say 15 or whatever, how many years you said it was, 17 years. Can you just think back to like some of the more like crazy days that you had? So try and, transport me to that moment and explain to us like how you feel. You're sitting in this chair and you're watching the screens and it's just mayhem. Like, what is it? Mm-hmm. What does it feel like?
Electrifying. It's amazing. They were the best moments. But obviously there was something going on geopolitically that you truly didn't understand. And obviously it was going to be bad for someone either at that exact point or further down the line. The most ridiculous one I can remember was back in, would have been around the back end of 98. And the dollar yen, I think the Bank of Japan just devalued their currency like ridiculously. They just intervened, and I think I don't remember the exact numbers, but maybe dollar yen exchange rate went from like 120 to like 140 in the blink of an eye, which was unseen, unheard of, unbeknownst to anybody that was going to happen. And all of a sudden, everybody, of course, now has to, remarket their positions. And I remember I was in Tokyo at the time that this happened, and it happened right towards the end of the day as well, Tokyo time. And we were there, sat in the office till about 10:30 at night, I think, and trading into London and then into New York as well, because that time zone come on board. And nobody knew what was going on. It was just complete mayhem. Prices were just getting flung around the floor. Trading was just happening instantly because the banks were trying to just manage these positions. It was complete damage control, especially in short-dated positions, because these are the ones that are coming up for expiration. And you just got to get out of them as soon as you can. It doesn't matter. Any price, just get me a price. Make me a price and I'll trade on it. Like people would be making like overnight dollar yen, like 20 vol wide, like 2040 or something. And someone in my mind, overnight, just get me some overnight. It doesn't matter. And then the next price would be like 40-60. It would just be, crazy. I know these numbers probably don't mean much to many people listening, but these were incredible times. And then, another big event would be the tsunami that rolled through Japan, and the markets go very eerily quiet for a couple of days when something so like catastrophic happens, and everybody's kind of like taking stock, trying to figure out, you know, what's happening, what does this mean? But then of course, you know, government response that ripple through the market, and that changes people's positions. And all of a sudden, 3 days later, everybody's yelling and screaming at each other again because they've got to remarket their positions and rebook trades or get out of trades very, very quickly. So that they're just a couple of examples. When you're on the desk during those times, the adrenaline just takes over. You become, I mean, it sounds a bit woo-woo, but you become almost superhuman. You like, you can hear absolutely everything. You can hear every conversation. You can hear what somebody's saying across the other side of the room. You can hear, like, four of your clients might be shouting at you at the same time, but you can hear each one of them perfectly fine, and you can execute each of these orders perfectly fine. And you get into this, like, flow state, I suppose. And that is such an incredible feeling. And you know, come the end of one of those days, you know, I could do this every day because you've been in that flow state, the adrenaline's been running, and everything's gone well. And of course, you've made a shit ton of commission because it's been busy. Yeah. But those days would be few and far between. Generally, for those people listening that think, you know, these high flyers in the city and whatever else looks like a great job, generally you're sitting around bored as arseholes all day long, playing practical jokes on each other, which, you know, again, can be quite fun. But the stress is very high. If you, for whatever reason, are deemed to not be performing, you get your salary cut pretty quickly, pretty harshly, or you just end up being kicked out of the door. And that can be for no reason of your own. You know, you might have spent 4 or 5 years building great relationships with people in certain positions at certain banks, and then for whatever reason, three of those guys get moved across to different centers, and overnight, you're fucked. You've got no business, and you've got to try and like start all over again. But it's very difficult for you to get relationships back because there's younger guys coming in, and they're naturally being attracted to the younger guys that come through your broking desk, and they've already got those relationships in place. So you can't go sniping relationships. So you just have to hope that the new person coming in is going to either one, have an existing relationship with you, or is going to be just attracted to the way that you conduct business. Otherwise, he might have an existing relationship with one of the other brokers on the desk, and he's just going to say, oh, well, I'm now the foreign exchange trader for XYZ Bank, and I would like to speak to David rather than you. Line gone, and business gone, and commission gone, and most likely salary cut, and or you get moved to a different desk. You know, it's very, very cutthroat.
There's a saying in the shipbreaking space that you're only as good as your last fixture. So a fixture is the same as what you'd call a trade, and it holds so true in the broking world, where you know, you can be as good as you want, and you can have a terrific 12 months, and you can get a great big bonus, and you go, happy days, I'm fucking good at this. And then the year later, you realize that two of your most important customers that you did lots of business in between have actually moved on to different departments within their companies. And therefore, you know, your mate at the next door broking shop's actually best buddies with the new incoming people, and you don't do a single fixture. And it's like, how do you, I mean, one of the greatest characteristics of shipbrokers is resilience. Some of my friends that do this now, they've done it for over 10 years. They are so fucking resilient. It's unbelievable how they've carried on doing it. And I'm always incredibly impressed, to be honest. It's so fascinating, this, and you talk about it. There are lots of similarities, but equally very, very different. And talking of asking questions, why? So the original story that you mentioned about the yen US dollar, and you're up at 10:30 at night, and you're doing a ton of trades, and you're feeling superhuman, and like, it's that flight or fight mechanism like kicked in, hasn't it? And you're just absolutely smashing it. And I kind of also know the feeling as well. But why did the exchange rate change at the time? And did anyone stop to ask any questions?
No one asks questions. No one.
Wow.
No one cares. Especially the brokers. They just don't care. Because it's all reactionary. It's purely reactionary. And, you know, the global macro guys, they will tell you, well, yeah, you know, we saw this coming and blah, blah, blah. It's all bullshit. Like, no one knows. No one knows. The ripple effects of some, you know, domino toppling over somewhere and how that just, you know, kind of ripples through the market. No one can guess. And so all of these, like, global macro traders that think that they're... you know, put them on a spot trading desk, or put them on the as like a head of foreign exchange on an options desk in a bank somewhere. It wouldn't last 2 minutes. It wouldn't last 2 minutes because they believe that they're the only way to trade markets is to deeply research things and like a quant would in air quotes, because goodness knows what that actually means. And then decide after 4 weeks of deep research that, yeah, this is the trade that we need to put on. So then, but they wouldn't put that trade on that themselves. They would have to go to the, what you'd say, front desk and ask those guys, the traders themselves, can you get me a price in this? And they would have to go into the market and they would have to find it. And they would do all like the hard work and getting the best deal and, you know, being reactionary against what was going on, like that minute to minute kind of play. So nobody asks really. Like now, even, you know, I still have lots of colleagues in that arena still there, still plying their trade. They won't listen to me about Bitcoin. They won't ask themselves what is money. They're too busy and don't give a fuck. I've got numbers to quote and I've got, you know, business to get. And, you know, at the end of the day, I'm knackered, or I've got to take a client out two or three times a week. Or I get home and I just sink into my sofa and watch Netflix or help put the kids to bed or something. Nobody has the time. And that's the travesty of modern life, because we don't have that time. We're always running 1,000 miles an hour to stand still rather than take a deep breath, ask the big questions, delve into it. And it's only the Bitcoiners that have managed to free themselves from this fiat existence and start asking these questions and start, you know, delving into history and trying to figure out where all of this kind of joins up and what Bitcoin means, that we start getting the great articles and the great books from people that have managed to do that. And, you know, huge kudos to those people, because I learned from, you know, the Bitcoin plebs, the maxis, that managed to extricate themselves and put their time and effort into educating others.
It's so fascinating, isn't it? Wow, and here we are on a Bitcoin podcast.
Trying to educate others.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a brilliant segue point, to be honest. You wrote a book called Choose Life. Now, I confess I'm only 50% of the way through it, so I haven't completely finished it. But you're no longer a Forex broker, and you made some big decisions in your life to go in a very different direction. So talk to us a bit about that. Like, why did you decide to leave your role as a Forex broker? What were some of the challenges you were facing at the time, and where did it take you?
Yeah, okay. I remember coming in one morning, the start of 2012, would have been the first day back after the Christmas break, and bending down under my desk and turning my computer on, and just this rush of dread just flowed over me. And I just remember thinking, I cannot do another 10 to 20 of this. I just can't. And I was 35 at the time, I imagine. You know, that year started unfolding. It was just a really challenging year. A couple of those things started happening, like people moving banks, clients and relationships I'd held for a long time started moving on. So it was just all this kind of gradual unravel. And I was doing the classic 1,000 miles an hour, you know, to stand still, earning a pretty decent wage, but getting to the end of the month at net zero. And I could not figure out how or why. And we'd made a lot of life changes at that point, you know, trying to cut back on everything. We had the surprise twin pregnancy that came along. So we went from 2 to 4 kids. So a lot of big, you know, massive changes. And I just decided that I wanted to try and do something different. So the first thing I ended up doing, so by September, I'd left and I went across to work for a friend of mine that was opening a recruitment firm in Singapore. He was expanding. So I went across and tried recruitment out. You know, it's instead of brokering money and foreign exchange, you're brokering people and companies. Like you're matching, right? You're connecting, you're taking the information in the marketplace and you're trying to match two people together. And you know, same thing, you make commission on that trade. I really didn't like that. It's not a great business at all, the recruitment industry. You end up, I saw, you know, the wider industry basically is just a lot of not giving a fuck about people and just trying to smash them into jobs for the sake of a commission rather than I actually care about your life and want to try and find the right role for you. That's not the case at all. I ended up doing that for about 6 months. And in the end, I was approached by a commodity trading and broking house to broker and trade soft oils out of Southeast Asia. So primarily palm oil, which is another disgusting product that, you know, ends up in the biofuels, gets greenwashed as biofuel, but basically ends up in pretty much every damn product possible. And not only that, coconut oil and soybean oil and all of this other, you know, toxic sludge stuff. I only lasted that for a year and I just could not stick that. And it didn't sit properly. And I read a book called The 4-Hour Work Week, and that changed my thinking, just turned my mind upside down. And I'd found this blog post on Tim Ferriss's site about a guy called Brandon Pierce and his wife that taken their 3 kids out of school and traveling the world and extricated themselves from their overbearing religion as well. And it's like, oh wow, like, okay, what's this idea? And started looking into that and realized there's a lot of families out there that were doing the same kind of thing. And we kept stumbling across different blogs and posts and about how families are just trying to live differently. So that mixed with Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Work Week, made me realize this is something I would be really interested in pursuing. My wife at the time, she was very kind of cognizant of the fact that the kids were not getting a great education, a state education in Singapore, because of course we'd cut back on the private education, you know, ridiculously expensive. So we upped and left. We pretty much sold everything we owned and we were gone within 4 months of me reading that book. And wow. That was where we started our that's the moment, I guess, I decided to choose life rather than choosing running on somebody else's hamster wheel, working to somebody else's schedule, something which we get programmed to do through the state education system. You know, a 5-year-old no longer owns their time. A 5-year-old, as soon as they walk through those gates, they're on somebody else's time. Somebody else is deciding what they are going to do for the rest of that day. And that is that is done intentionally to program people into believing that they're just non-player characters and drones.
They'd love to hear
that. That's where that all stems from.
Oh, mate, you're a drone. So something that, so I've done about 30 or so episodes now. People that have, for any other way of describing this, adopted Bitcoin in a meaningful way are generally the characters I'm speaking to. And I'm asking them why, you know, what lens do they see of the world? How did they get to this point? What have they done previously that meant that they saw the value proposition and have made a large step in the direction of, you know, becoming, so to speak, a Bitcoiner? One thing that easily flows through all of them is the ability to react to the situations that they're in and also make bold calls. So I'm sure there are a lot of people out there that would say you were fucking crazy to quit the Forex job that you had when you've just had like an extra baby by not meaning to, which in itself is stressful, right? You know, I've made this decision. I'm going this direction. You've got all this flack for it. It's like, thank you. You can look after yourselves. Talk to me a bit about that. Like, there must be some real challenges involved, and specifically like having surprise twins. Like, wow, I mean, what a, you know, gorgeous treat. But at the same time, like, that wasn't part of the plan. And to then say, right, I'm ripping the rule book up and I'm going in a different direction. What were some of the biggest challenges in that process? And do you have any days you remember where you were like particularly low, or dickhead characters that you came across who were like judging you for no reason? Do you know what I mean? Or no, they were judging you because your choices threatened their view of what's right. It's probably what happened, but I'd love to hear a bit more about some of those trickier moments.
Exactly that. Yeah, I remember it pretty vividly, because you see, the thing is, you go through these big decisions. They're not knee-jerk reactions, and I guess they are in a sense, because something all of a sudden just twigs in your mind, and I guess that's the knee-jerk reaction. But then you're not gone the next day. Like, that begins the research process, and that begins the deep dive, and that begins the sleepless nights, and that begins the long talks with your significant other, to try and figure all of this out. And that was months that we, like I said, you know, 4 months ever after reading the book the first time. I was reading it and reading it and reading it. I think I read it 5 months in total, just back to back. I just couldn't believe what I was reading, and had to, I guess I used it, that extra reading of the book, to just keep telling myself, you're not fucking crazy. But because, you know, your monkey mind is your biggest enemy. And some days you would wake up and you'd be like, no, what was I thinking? Whatever. Just another 20 years. You know, you can do all that when you're 60, 65. If you play the cards right, you know, you should be done by then. Yeah. If you get there, one. Maybe 55. You can shoot for 55, but let's play maybe 60. You can start doing all this stuff when the kids are set and they've got their own kids, and you know, it's all you can, you know. And then you'd be like, yeah, so yeah, I'll take that pill, and you quiet your mind. But then by like halfway through the day, you're like, I cannot do another fucking meeting. I just can't. I cannot. And those feelings will start bubbling up again. So you go through the process. And I remember talking about this in the book. Fear is the main thing, the fear of the unknown. And that's why people are just more than happy to sit there doing the same thing for 50 years and believe the lies that they're told about, you know, there's golden part at the end of the rainbow and you'll all be looked after. Your healthcare will be looked after and you'll get your pension, all of this kind of nonsense. The hardest thing to do is challenge that narrative, but then all of the fears that just come up within your own mind. And so I followed what Ferris talked about in the book, and I did what's called a fear setting exercise instead of a goal setting exercise, where you write down your biggest fears. And, you know, you just list them, could be 5, could be 10, doesn't matter. Just list them down, whatever comes first to you instinctively, what is my biggest fear? Write that down, and then write down what you would do to like reverse whatever that problem is that came up. You know, who would you call? How would you go about it? What would you put in place? How would you handle it? And then another step after that, what would be the likely outcome if you did put all those things into place, and if they did, you know, result in some kind of solution? And it's really powerful exercise, because, you know, my number one fear, I think, was going bankrupt and living under a bridge, homeless in cardboard boxes with my wife and kids. Having let everybody down. And so once I'd written that down on paper, first of all, you see how ridiculous it is. Like, that's what's actually in your mind. And second of all, you're like, well, how would I fix that? Well, damn, like how would I end up living under a bridge when we both have two brothers, we both have parents, and between our existing like tight-knit family, there's like several houses that we could go and, you know, live in.
So, okay, camp, well, in the garden or something, at, you know.
Like, and they've all got several spare bedrooms. So like, okay. So we would never, ever be homeless and living under a bridge. We would still be, you know, living with each other, with family, with three square meals a day. So, you know, take that fear off the table. Okay, what's fear number two? And you just go down it and you just work through it logically. But we're not programmed to do that. We're programmed just to look at that fear immediately and say, no, just stick with the status quo and that won't happen. And that's what keeps us all trapped in our little corners. You know, many of us end up in careers we never, ever studied to do. We just fell into that role and somehow that role kept morphing and morphing because you follow the little paths when they're presented to you. And, you know, you paint yourself into this corner. It's just up to you to like walk across the wet paint, I suppose. Like, what's the worst that can happen? Like, just go and be done with it, and start trying to take control of your own decisions and your own life. And that's what we found once we'd left and we started traveling. You know, it was all on us then. Like, everything was on us. Especially the education, which was a big part of it. But like you said, when you present this to people, I'm quitting, we're going, and this is what we're going to do. They don't know the months of mind processing that you've done. To them, it's like knee-jerk reaction. You're fucking crazy. Shut up, sit back down, and get on with your job, because you know you're being irresponsible and you've not thought about the kids. And all of this just comes flowing out of them. And it's the same worries that you've had, because they're knee-jerk worries and knee-jerk fears, but they've not gone through the process that you've gone through to find the answer and to find the truth at the end of it, that actually there is very little risk of any of these fears coming to fruition. And in fact, what actually happens is a complete opposite. None of them come to fruition and all of you flourish in ways that you would never have even guessed or imagined.
Wonderful. And that's quite an easy prompt for me to ask next. So what happened that you didn't expect? So, you know, fucking good on you. You took a risk that you never expected yourself to be capable of. Everyone told you shouldn't do it, and you did it anyway. And so, what have been some of those unexpected kind of flourishings that have happened as a family?
The biggest one for me. So this was back in 2014, March 2014, that we left and we started to travel, and we were doing the traveling via sharing economy, either home swapping, because we had a property that we'd bought 16 years ago on a small Thai island called Koh Samui. So we had that property in place, which we could first of all go and use for a couple of months and take a breather and try and, you know, process. Oh shit, we did actually do that. Right, okay, so now what next? So we used that. We found a website called lovehomeswap.com, and we just listed the house. We're like, okay, let's see what happens. And within days, we were getting people from Bulgaria or Sweden or Australia or Austria asking whether they'd be we would be interested in doing a swap with them.
Wow.
Well, shit, this clearly works. So started falling down that rabbit hole. And then there's other services within the sharing economy where you can, your family can go and work for food and shelter. You can go to farms, for example, or projects that people are putting together where they welcome families and they've got extra shelter and they can offer you the shelter. You give up your morning to help them work on whatever it is that they're trying to achieve. And then you take the afternoon to spend with the time with the family and go and explore the surrounding area, the countryside or the town, wherever you're in. So an unexpected thing for me was a total restoration in faith in humanity. Because when you open yourself up to people in this way, when you're a young family my wife and I at the time, we were 37. We had an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old, and 2 3-year-olds in tow. Wow. We were a big unit, right? But people were welcoming us with open arms, and offering us accommodation and offering us food, offering us their house, obviously in exchange for ours, so they were getting something back. But sometimes, you know, the dates didn't match and we would be staying, like New Zealand, for example. We turned up at this couple's house and they had a small annex. And they said, are you sure you're not going to be comfortable in there? Like, it's just tiny. We were like, we don't care. We want to come to New Zealand. We want to explore Christchurch and the whole of the South Island. All we need is a roof over our heads and you can go and stay in our place in Kosamui, you know, whenever you want. And that's how we struck the deal. And so we lived on their property next door to them for 10 days, 2 weeks. And they would cook us barbecues. They would invite us over when their friends were coming. They helped us out with buying a car because we bought a car when we were in New Zealand because we were going to be there for 3 months. They told us all the best places to go, where to go shopping, and you know, fixed problems for us, made phone calls for us, you know, just absolutely everything. Complete strangers. Wow. And this kept happening time and time again. And, wow. You know, that this, it was a deprogramming of everyone's out to get you. Everyone's out there for their own interests and, you know, don't care about you. It is complete nonsense. So we were completely blown away by that. And that was a real kind of awakening, especially for me, because I'd been such a blinded, stressed out, asshole, for want of a better word, that didn't want to talk to people because I'd be talking to people 10-11 hours a day. So when I got home and my wife would say to me, so-and-so's invited us over Saturday afternoon for you know, play date for the kids, and we're like, I'm like, I ain't fucking going, what the hell are you talking about, that's my weekend, like, you know.
Wow.
So for me it was a complete awakening of the real me as well, because you know, you remove yourself from that environment and you realize as you probably attest to, you're a different person when you're on the phone shipbroking than you are to doing a Bitcoin podcast.
Yes,
you will wear a different mask.
Yeah, although there are some similarities in terms of, and I should have asked you about this earlier, we've moved on already, but relationship building is a big part of the job, and podcasting is also a networking game. So there are definitely some crossovers to it. But yeah, I don't talk about my view in the world quite the same way at work. There's no doubt about that. Yeah,
absolutely not. No. So you know, it's tiring to play that game, and when you can be released from it, you certainly do find. It's a transformation, and you go through it, and it's weird, and you have this loss of identity as well, which is huge, which I think a lot of Bitcoiners are going to face, when have already faced, actually, because if you're as advanced down the rabbit hole as I'm sure many of your listeners are, they would have gone through this, like, oh my God, you know, lie after lie after lie that just gets exposed, and you're like, but my identity was built around that lie, like, or part thereof. So therefore, you know, who am I? It's the classic Zoolander 2 scene, right? You know, where you're just screaming across each other, who am I? That's what Bitcoin does to you. And it's true, because you have this, it crosses over between two things: imposter syndrome, which, you would suffer from as well, I'm sure, doing this podcast. Many of us podcasters suffer from that. But also within, like, your close family, friends, when you become the Bitcoin guy and you start speaking up against all of the bullshit, and they just keep smashing you down, calling you a conspiracy theorist or whatever, imposter syndrome can kick in, because like, you're like, who am I? I'm not actually certified, in air quotes again, to espouse about the state of the economy because I do not have a PhD in economics, and this is why people aren't taking me seriously. Whereas we know the PhD economist has been fed an absolute bunch of bullshit and doesn't actually have an open mind to listen to another point of view. So you have that, and then you also have this loss of identity because of the career you've built yourself up around.
You're a broker.
All of a sudden start.
I'm a broker. Sorry? You know, you're a broker. That's what you do. Yeah. You know, you've done that for 15 years. What else are you going to do? Right. You're a fucking broker. Yeah, come on.
Exactly.
All your mates are brokers. So, that's what you do all day. Like, come on. What else are you going to do?
That's all it is.
It's so interesting. Wow. What a challenge. I mean, life's crazy, isn't it? The twists and turns. You just can't ever predict where it's going to go. And it's, you know, I guess it's that process of just wanting to know.
That's what we should be embracing, though. That is the pure beauty of life. That's what we should be embracing. This fucking narrative that we've been fed that life is linear is the disease. Mm. And again, it starts very early, as young as three, if you're, you know, in kindergarten or some other countries around the world, especially here in France, where they start kids at school at three. That's where this lineation begins. That's where you start being fed this bullshit about keep your head down, do your work, turn up on time, wear this, don't wear that, and everything will be fine. You'll get a good job, you get the 2.4, you'll get the freaking white picket fence, and you'll get a car each and a nice great big house and the mowed lawn with stripes. Like, you know, this embracing that is toxic because it doesn't exist. Embracing change and challenges and like problem solving, that's true life, that's choosing life, because that's all that life is. It's forever changing. That's the only constant we should ever embrace as human beings, because change never stops. That's the nature of the universe. Like, you know, it shouldn't sound so
confronting, but to a lot of people it really is what you're talking about, what we're talking about here. And it's all a natural process of evolution. Like, your mindset just changes over time, and this is kind of where that whole saying of like, you are what you think kind of comes into play, in that, you know, the rabbit hole of research that you choose to go down does affect how you think and how you see the world. Like, I actually find myself now in a position of far more optimism than I've ever been in, not just for my own self and my family, but equally for the entire world. And that's because of Bitcoin, which is extraordinary. Why has that changed my mindset? And that's what this podcast is all about, is talking to people, how has things changed? And you're a great example, and tell a brilliant story as well.
If your choice of research is to sit down in front of the television to watch the 10 o'clock news, you're fucked.
Yeah, or
because,
yeah, joke's on you.
Because you are being told what to think.
Yeah.
So if you are what you think, and your choice of research is mainstream media or corrupted BBC or anyone like that, that is just feeding you narrative at you know, a specifically chosen time of day. The boomers are so captured when you look at this, because they all do the same. They just get into this catatonic state about 10 o'clock at night, and they just watch this 30-minute scripted show to have the biggest impact on their behavior the next day. It's social engineering. It's called programming for a reason. Mm. And if that is your chosen choice of research, if you're not going to pick up a book, if you're not going to think critically about this, if you're not going to look at the other side of the coin and ask the big question, well, does that sound true? Or find out what else is not being reported and why, then you're going to end up sad. Mm. And you're going to end up nihilistic.
Scared and fearful.
Exactly, you know, that.
From what you're being told every day. Oh, it's crazy, isn't it? I mean, that's a brilliant rabbit hole in itself. But I want to avoid us steaming down that one for now, because I will keep the conversation for just an hour. We could talk 4 hours, Daniel. But in this case, we'll have to do another one in the future at some stage, see how things have developed. I had some questions from some Twitter friends. And so shout out to Peter Dunworth, who's been a huge supporter of my progress with this show. But he had a question: what time commitment per week does homeschooling require? And before you steam in and answer that, there's a section that I've got to in your Choose Life book. And it's really inspiring. I've just had one child, well, 2 years ago now, and the second one's due. And the educational system is something I'm really asking questions about. So the model that you have proposed and living is fascinating to me. So I just want to bring up the moment in Choose Life where you talk about turning up in a random supermarket and there's some chick sitting behind the till and she looks at you and your wife with your four kids, not in school, in outside of school holiday time or something, and just judges you straight away and goes, what the fuck are you doing? And you have to answer to her, even though there's no reason why you should. So that I just want to chuck in that as a really funny moment that I imagine you've had to negotiate many times, but you've got four great kids that have been what you call world schooled or homeschooled, and it's something you're really passionate about. And then obviously chuck in Pete's question as well. So just talk to me a bit about that process and, you know, taking kids out of traditional schooling and what it's meant to you guys as a family.
Oh yeah. So much. The first thing that the point that should be really hammered home here for anybody listening, please understand that for most of you living in countries around the world, you do have a choice. A lot of us don't even realize that there is a choice, that there is a parallel system. We have been brainwashed into believing that this is the only way human beings can learn, by turning up a set brick and mortar place for a set amount of time, wearing a set uniform is the only way a conscious human being can learn. Like, just thinking about that for a second is just absolutely completely nuts. So I was on that train. I was like, you know, get the kids in the best school that you possibly can. Then you fall into this other trap as well. Like, you know, if you sent one kid to a school, then all the kids should go to that school because everyone must have the same opportunity in life. You can't be seen to favor one child. And again, what complete nonsense. Every single one of your kids is going to be completely freaking different. So it doesn't matter what school you sent the first one to and whether that did or didn't work. It's not going to necessarily be the same for the other one or two following. But that's another trap people get stuck in. Especially if it's an expensive kind of private school, then of course you've got to do the same for the second one. These are, you know, very easy little trapdoors to fall into. So homeschooling, the first thing people think about when you think about homeschooling, because it's bad marketing, it's like Bitcoin. Like, well, what do you mean I can't hold it? Homeschool doesn't work. You know, you cannot take a kid out of an institutionalized day with set times for set lessons with set different teachers and bring that model into the home. Doesn't work, and nor should it. The only way that would ever work is in an institution that has been designed that way, because that natural learning happens completely differently. When you think, and Peter Gray's written about this in his book, Free to Learn. We still are learning every single day as Bitcoiners in our adult years. I don't think I've learned more in the last even 6 months, because I cannot stop freaking learning. I know people listening to this, you've been relit, like, you know, did this passion inside of you to find truth or to do research into something, and it just so happens that our research of choice is Bitcoin. But you know, for kids, that could be anything. That could be digging holes in the ground, that could be climbing trees, that could be picking up a musical instrument, that could be playing a sport, that could be writing, just doodling, drawing, whatever. All of these things that you're not allowed to explore in an institutionalized setting, because woe betide you be caught doodling and looking out of the window when you're supposed to be listening to your French teacher. So the idea of school at home is a misnomer, and it's not like the wife and I sorry, we did do this to begin with. Like, we made all of the big, the newbie mistakes. We had the timetable set out on an A4 piece of paper, and don't forget twins, three. Like, what were we doing? 3 years old. Don't forget, we're going to be doing
you've got maths today.
9:30. We're going to be doing a little bit of finger painting or something. And so, you know, off with mummy to do that. And Sophia and Caitlin, we're going to go do some spelling. So spelling with daddy outside. Like, you know, the pushback, mate, it doesn't work.
Mm.
It does not work. You cannot bring that kind of setting into the home. So how many hours a day do you very little.
So yeah, Peter's question was what time commitment per week does homeschooling require?
Yeah, okay.
Which is probably, to your point, that's a school mentality. Like, school is about setting a timetable. And what you're saying is, if you're going to go and take this route, you've got to just remove that entire predisposition to what you know as school, essentially. This is just a whole different way of doing
You have to go through a de-schooling process. And if you do not go through that de-schooling process, especially the parents who have likely been institutionalized themselves, it's a big mess. Because the kids have to de-school and you have to de-school. But it's more important that you de-school. And to de-school yourself, you've really got to step away, like take a huge leap back and de-school yourself, even from certification, and get that off your back. Because, my kids are never going to be able to get a job because they're not going to have GCSE or what do you call them in Australia?
Oh, I don't even know. I did A-levels back in the UK. So, yeah, my wife's Aussie. All that kind of stuff.
All that kind of stuff, right? And you've got to kind of de-school yourself away from that before you can start even putting trust in the fact that your child is learning and putting trust in the fact that they might look as though they're bored. They might look as though they're doing absolutely nothing, but something is always, as we know, is always going on in our minds.
Mm.
So some weeks, it could be very little, but other weeks when you see that spark, when you see that interest in something, then you run with it. And that's when you can get involved and start helping. The an easy example would be show an interest in a musical instrument. Go buy that musical instrument, put it in their hands, see what happens after a week or two. If they're still playing around with it, then book some lessons or go down to the local kind of community center, find out where the local bands are, find out where people like this with this interest are congregating, jam them in there. Son likes to play football. Go find the local football team. Get him training with them twice a week. Get them lost in something. And then, you know, where does that spur other interests and just being open to that? But of course, you know, have books around. Read with them. Because reading, you beget spelling and grammar. Just not by sitting down, rote learning it and copying off of a whiteboard, but by sitting down, losing yourself in stories together. And you know, it's truly very important. Math, you can do that in various ways. Again, it's all happening naturally. But then you can now, there's so much online. You know, there's a great Australian math teacher called Eddie Wu, teaches middle school maths, I think. But he's so entertaining, and all he did was put a video camera in his actual classroom. So he's got a class full of kids and all you see is the back of their heads or just him. And they're firing questions at him, but he's teaching you about Pythagoras. He's teaching you about isosceles triangles and stuff like that. And I sit down and watch that with the kids and they'll watch it because he's animated and he's funny. And then we can start having discussions about this. And then you start learning because, you know, what you realize is you've remembered almost none of this from school and it's never been relevant to any part of your life, a lot of these things, but now because you've got a renewed love of learning, you're like, okay, that makes a lot more sense. And you start getting passionate about things that you never thought you'd have got passionate about just because you're spending a little bit of time with the kids trying to, you know, help them on their journey. But it's easy to get caught up in this idea of it's got to be a 9-to-5 day. I can't do that. I'm working already. I can't take the time out to homeschool my own kids. the other one, fear, I'm not qualified enough to teach my own kids. We've been, you know, fooled into thinking that there are only these magical beings on the planet with these certificates that say that they're they've passed a teaching degree, that therefore they're the only ones that are allowed to teach other human beings. Again, complete nonsense. So a bit of a rant. I got lost in there.
But, no, I loved all of it. It's very inspirational for me, Daniel, at a particular time in my life. So I'm 34 at the moment. So very similar stage to when you've, let's say you've taken a different direction to where you were going. I find context is so interesting with learning. Like the stuff I read about as a result of asking the question, what is money, is in some pretty niche forms of economics and all sorts of other areas that I never expected to actually research. But because you've got context for your requirement to learn, you start learning. And perhaps when it comes to de-schooling, the child might be doing an activity that actually requires a skill that you can give them context for, and therefore they learn what they needed to learn anyway. That really makes a lot of sense to me. But yeah, so Daniel, at the risk of going a little over time to usual, what we haven't really talked about, as like maybe another 5 minutes or so, is Bitcoin.
Sure.
Which is the whole point of being on the call. But if you could kind of wrap it all together a bit for those listening, you know, why has Bitcoin become an important part of your life? You're obviously, you know, running a great podcast and talking to people all day long, helping educate them about it. It fits very naturally into the idea of the more nomadic lifestyle that you and your family have chosen to live. It's a digital asset that you can take with you anywhere in the world that no one can take off you. Over time, it's performing extremely well from a purchasing power perspective versus any other asset. You know, happy days. But yeah, how does it all wrap together, and when did it really become part of this journey for you?
Yeah, I guess having gone through the initial unplugging of what was expected of me, like it was, I honestly felt as I was unplugging from the matrix when I quit my job and we started to travel, and I could breathe. I could, it was like the weirdest feeling, mate. Like you would hear the birds, like you'd completely shut out. Like you could breathe clearer. You could think clearer. You could see wider. And I've had other people on my podcast talk about this as well, who've done the same, Josias Carbon in particular. And I felt freedom, mate. I felt freedom because we were traveling. We were bouncing from country to country. You know, the longest we'd stay in any one country, it was 2 months in Australia. And then we went off down to New Zealand, 3 months in New Zealand. And then we spent 2 to 3 months between Canada and the US. No one knows you're there. You're a perpetual tourist. No one's after you for any reason. No one's checking up on, you know, like the homeschooling police aren't coming to check up on your kids or anything like that. Bills aren't chasing you around, you know, all of these day-to-day grinds that get you down were suddenly gone, and you weren't part of anybody's system. You weren't, you know, even though you were in that country, you weren't in that country, if you know what I mean. You didn't have to. I mean, of course,
you didn't have utility bills like coming through, or you hadn't have tax bills to pay, and you know, health insurance costs. You probably had a travel insurance package or something. But I get what you mean. That kind of.
Yep.
That, like, you know, what was that? Oh, that's that direct debit. Oh, what was that? Oh, that's that thing we needed to buy. Oh, you know, and I'm like, yes, I can imagine mm-hmm. that would be very different.
So all that was on us was figuring out our itinerary. Obviously, banking, you had to keep on top of that because you're different currencies. But
yeah,
for me, that was okay. I had a lot of experience doing that. Finding accommodation, making sure you've got a shelter over your head. You know, all of a sudden it's like, oh, wow, right. There's Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Right, bam, we're living that. But when, you know, it was just this immense feeling of freedom. And that's when I started that, you know, all the way back to the beginning of cool, who is that annoying Bitcoin mate? There wasn't one, because I started falling down the rabbit hole when we were on, we were just a family unit, and I would be up late at night watching, interviews or YouTube videos, or I don't think there are any podcasts around those days. Just trying to read articles, anything I could find. As I slowly started unraveling what Bitcoin was, why it was important. And I'd known about it prior when I was in foreign exchange. I'd known about it because, of course, like, you know, it was talked about. It's like, yeah, stupid geek internet money for morons. Like, you know, no one's ever going to, there's never going to become a thing.
I can imagine it at lunch with a bank going, oh, what? Have you heard the Bitcoin price lately? Yeah, fucking crash, hasn't it? Waste of time, that stuff. Or whatever. Oh, it's booming. Oh, it's got to be a Ponzi or whatever. I know exactly the vibe. Yeah.
All of that. So having tasted freedom and then realizing, like you said at the beginning of this question, the freedom Bitcoin offers you is, why would you want to be tied into that payment rail system that has done nothing but abuse you ever since you entered it, pretty much, when there's this other thing? And it's not even what I love about it. What I love about it, it's like, you're not, you know, the game is rigged as it is. And yet we all still are forced to turn up at the table and play this game. And you're never going to win. You might do okay at it, but you're never going to win. The people winning are the globalist billionaire, trillionaire, you know, deeply entrenched, deep state kind of people that are going to rug pull you whenever they want and transfer wealth, whether that transfer of wealth is confiscating your gold in 1933 or you know, purposely collapsing stock markets to take all your equities, or purposely collapsing real estate market to take all your houses. This happens time and time again. It's been happening for centuries, and it's only going to get worse. So you can go and sit at that table. You can glance over here and like, oh, what are those guys doing? And there's a completely new game over there, and where the rules are way fairer. And all you got to do is be curious and go over there and ask a few questions and start figuring it out for yourself and figure out what table you want to play at. And for me, Bitcoin is this parallel system that has been, you know, built by the people for the people, as we say in the space, which I'm more than happy to have, you know, kind of hung my cap on that hook, started the podcast, and wanted to educate as many other people as I can out there as to what this could mean to them. For their future and for their family, because this is not to be ignored anymore. Here we are, 13 years later, and this thing isn't going away. And every time someone attacks it, it just comes back stronger.
Yeah, amen to that. Well, it sounds like a brilliant place to pause the conversation until our next get together, whenever that might be. So my last question, Daniel, is where can people get in touch with you when they want to reach out?
Yeah, absolutely. Find me on Twitter. It's at Princey, S-O-V, and the S-O-V stands for store of value, because that is truly what I believe Bitcoin is right now. It will become a widely accepted medium of exchange in the future. By widely, I mean, like, you know, a lot more merchants adopting it than at current times. But if you do want to store your value, this is the one place to do it. But do your own research, listen to more of Jake's pods. If you want to read the book, you can find that on, don't go to Amazon, go to Consensus Network, and that's spelt with a K, Consensus Network, because that's been put together by a guy called Nico, and it's his mission to translate or transform, I should say, because translating is not the right word for, you know, a work of written text. You've got to transform it into a native language. And he's doing that to as many Bitcoin or Bitcoin related books as possible. And he really enjoyed my book, and he asked if it would be okay for him to list it. And I'm more than happy for him to do that. So go find it there. If you use Bitcoin, you'll get a 10% discount on it. If you use the code BITTEN, you'll get further 10% discount on it. So I would love to, push more people towards Consensus Network, and then go buy a different book, you know, the Bitcoin Standard or 21 million or something in a different language for one of your friends that speak that language, and use that as a gift, and use that as a little orange pilling moment. You can also find me at the Once Bitten podcast. So just go to go to Fountain app, of course, because that's the way we can support each other. You get sats for listening. We get sats as content creators, and it's a brilliant platform. For the guys that were asking about homeschooling, I have interviewed on the podcast a few people that you should definitely check out those interviews. It's not Bitcoin related. It's all about the education system. One is called Peter Gray, Naomi Fisher, and Sir Ken Robinson as well. I had done an interview with him before I started the podcast, but I released their audio. And there's a few families as well that have done the same thing. But, you'll be able to find those interviews. So thanks for having me on, brother.
Thank you so much for joining. I've always loved our conversations. This was another great one. So yeah, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time.
Catch you next time.
Well done, friends. You made it to the end of the episode. I couldn't be more grateful for you sharing this time with me and putting your energy into this project. If you like what you hear, please, first and foremost, share it with your friends and family. Getting the message out to those around us nearest and dearest, I think, is one of the most important things we can possibly do. On top of that, wherever you listen to this, please rate, subscribe, share, etc. I'd really appreciate the support there as I try and build out this podcast. And lastly, I'm looking to build a network of startups and founders in this space. So if you know anyone that's interested in building a business and is looking for investment, please send them in my direction. Thank you so much, guys. You've been listening to Bitcoin with Jude.